for listening to A Little More Conversation. I'm Ben O'Hara Byrne. Tonight, how does your brain react to music differently as you get older? You may think that as you age, you might actually like a lot less music than younger folks. Well, new research finds the exact opposite is true. So why is it, and why does it help us better understand the aging brain? We press play on that topic. One of the coolest teams and greatest shows on HGTV is back on Monday nights this spring, and designer Deborah Salmoni takes us behind the scaffolding for a look at season 5 of Scott's Vacation House Rules. Well, going into this week, it was hard to imagine that anything would be able to take the focus off Donald Trump's ongoing hush money trial in Manhattan. But growing student protests across the U.S. did just that, prompting comments from President Biden on Thursday. As we continue our weekly look into the state of play of the U.S. presidential election, we examine how the protests can hurt Joe Biden and why. But first, lots of developments today around the issue of foreign governments behaving badly in Canada. First, the preliminary report from the Inquiry on Foreign Interference in the 2019 and 2021 elections found that while it didn't affect the outcomes, there was indeed interference, mainly but not only by China. And Commissioner Marie-Josée Hoog called it a stain on our electoral process. So what stood out and what questions remain to be answered? And as that was happening in Ottawa, RCMP and BC were announcing the arrests of 3 suspects in the murder of a prominent Sikh activist in Surrey, BC. They were taken into custody in Edmonton in connection with the murder of Hardeep Singh Nijjar last June. And RCMP continued to investigate allegations that Indian intelligence orchestrated the murder of a Canadian on Canadian soil. And we begin tonight in BC with a major breakthrough in the murder of a prominent Sikh activist in the Vancouver suburb of Surrey last June. Hardeep Singh Nijjar was shot and killed as he left the Guru Nanak Sikh Gurdwara in June. And in September, the Prime Minister went public with this explosive allegation.
Over the past number of weeks, Canadian security agencies have been actively pursuing credible allegations of a potential link between agents of the government of India and the killing of a Canadian citizen, Hardeep Singh Nijjar.
Now, that allegation provoked denials and a furious backlash from India. But some context here. It was then revealed that U.S. authorities had foiled a plot to murder another prominent Sikh activist, and an Indian national working with an Indian government official had tried to hire a hitman to carry out that killing, a hitman who turned out to be an undercover federal agent. So it is within that context today that the RCMP announced that 3 Indian nationals had been arrested in connection with the murder of Nijjar in Surrey last June. The 3 men were taken into custody in Edmonton on Friday morning. The suspects entered Canada on student visas and had been here for between 3 and 5 years and may have been working at the direction of Indian intelligence. RCMP Assistant Commissioner David Tibble says, in addition to the murder case, there are separate investigations looking into the possible connections to India.
I will underscore that today's announcements are not a complete account of the investigative work currently underway. There are separate and distinct investigations ongoing into these matters, certainly not limited to the involvement of the people arrested today, and these efforts include investigating connections to the government of India.
Karan Brar, Karanpreet Singh, and Kamalpreet Singh are all facing charges of first-degree murder and conspiracy to commit murder. And again, the allegations point to a possible Indian government strategy to assassinate leaders of the Khalistan movement, which supports independence for India's Sikh-majority Punjab state. A spokesperson for the BC Gurdwaras Council says he was with Nijjar's family for the emotional moments when they learned of the arrests today. Maninder Singh says the family is feeling relief alongside some anger and frustration.
There's a bit of anger and frustration around why this had to happen in the first place. And then there's a lot of questions around India, that is this over, is this not over, how will we know, how do we go back into our community and have this conversation around, like, is it safe or is it not safe around certain parameters of what our movement is.
Now, those arrests came on the same day that the Inquiry into Foreign Interference released a preliminary report in Ottawa, and we'll get to that in the next half hour. But on the arrests in the Nijjar murder, what do we know about the suspects and their time in this country? And did India indeed help orchestrate the murder of a Canadian citizen on Canadian soil because he was perceived to be a political enemy? Those are very serious allegations. Joining me now is Stuart Bell. He's a senior investigative reporter with Global News. He's covered this case extensively. Stuart, thank you.
No problem.
This is a pretty, I mean, I don't know whether we just hadn't heard much about what was happening with this case. And suddenly here we are with three arrests. Who are these suspects?
Well, they're three Indian nationals. They came to Canada on student visas sometime in the last 3 years or so, and they've been living in Edmonton. The allegation is that they traveled to Surrey to commit the murder of Mr. Nijjar, and that's why the three of them were arrested in Edmonton this morning on murder and conspiracy charges, and they're being brought to BC by Monday. They're supposed to have a first court appearance.
Wow. Do we know who they are? I was reading that they weren't known to police. And as you mentioned, they're not Canadian residents. Do we have any idea of who they are?
I mean, not really. Just as I said, they're here as international students. My understanding is that that's not really what they're doing. There's some suggestion they may be involved in criminal activity. The bigger allegation, of course, is that and this is something that a source familiar with this matter has told us, that the RCMP believe that they may have been tasked by the Indian government to travel to Surrey to commit these this killing, which obviously raises it beyond a run-of-the-mill murder to something of international intrigue. You have basically a foreign government that has decided to assassinate somebody that they have long labeled an enemy of their country, and to do it on Canadian soil, and to do it by contracting, allegedly, people of Indian nationality within the country.
Did police get into that at all today? Because that's always been one of the storylines that's been traveling around, is that in fact the Indian government was committing or looking to commit extrajudicial killings on Canadian soil of people they perceive to be enemies of India in this case. And you've written about this a lot, sort of Sikh separatists in this country. Did the police talk at all today about what if any links they've come up with and what they may be?
You know, they really said very little about the investigation, but they did actually make a point of saying that they were still investigating, and that part of that ongoing investigation is the connection to the government of India. And on top of that, our sources are telling us that that they do believe that there is a connection. It appears that this plot traces back to the Indian Foreign Intelligence Service in New Delhi, which is known as RAW. And that this appears to be very similar to the assassination plot that we saw in New York, where RAW had contracted an organized crime figure to commit the murder of a U.S.-based pro-Khalistan activist. Fortunately, that plot was infiltrated by the FBI and that plot was disrupted. But it appears to be a very similar strategy here in Canada to orchestrate the plot from RAW headquarters in India, and to task local people to do it.
And in this case, I mean, if you sort of start to connect the dots, what it sounds like, because I gather I don't know whether there are other charges were laid today in connection with other crimes against these three, but there's been talk of other charges. You get the impression that you sort of had this group of sort of a band of essentially gangland associated hitmen traveling Western Canada, carrying out these gangland stuff, as well as potentially this one on behalf of the Indian government. It's pretty damning stuff, Stuart. And you've looked into this for quite a while.
Yeah, at this point, they've only been charged with the murder and the conspiracy to murder Mr. Nijjar. Mm-hmm. You know, it's actually becoming quite a phenomenon, not just with India, as we've seen, like, for example, in the Panoon case in the States, where they basically contracted out this work to a gangster. This is a similar thing that we're seeing with other countries as well, Iran and Russia in particular. The Iranians, there was a U.S. indictment unsealed a few months ago where Iran had contracted Canadian Hells Angels to kill dissidents in the United States. The Russians have been doing, we believe, similar things, using local criminals and crime groups to target opponents of Putin and supporters of Ukraine. You can understand why, I guess, as opposed to doing it themselves, they give themselves a little bit of distance from the crime by having others do it. But at the same time, the drawback is that you're contracting out criminals, basically, to do this kind of work who, you know, may not necessarily be as professional or as discreet as an intelligence service would be. And that's perhaps what's opened up these investigations, is that they were in the States, they were infiltrated by an undercover officer in Canada. The RCMP has been able to trace the shooters back to Edmonton and identify them, allegedly. So, yes.
I wouldn't suspect they would have detailed much of the investigation, but do you have any sense of how they were tracked down?
No, they didn't really get into a lot of detail like that. But, you know, there was a fair amount of video of the shooting itself, CCTV video, the car, you know, the getaway car as it was leaving the scene. They were very clear, though, that, you know, this is just the beginning. These are, from what we understand, believed to be the hitmen who conducted the shooting. But there were a number of other people that they believe were involved in those investigations are still unraveling. And don't forget also, Mr. Najjar was just one of several people that were warned that they were potentially at risk of killing. There were at least four others in the BC Lower Mainland that were given notices from the RCMP that they believe that there was a threat to their lives. And so there's that broader plot as well, that there's still an investigation going on into that.
Stuart Bell is the senior investigative reporter at Global News. We're talking about the arrest today of three men in Edmonton in connection with the assassination of a Sikh activist in BC almost a year ago now, and potential links to the government of India, or to the state of India, Indian intelligence, and just a little bit more. We don't know much about the three men. They're not Canadian citizens. They're here on student visas, apparently. They were not known to police. Stuart, where to from here then? I guess they'll make a court appearance on Monday. But as you pointed out, the investigation's not done yet. There are a lot of threads still to pull out here.
Yeah, well, you know, even though it's taken almost a year to get here, and you can only imagine how difficult it was to trace these people down, this was probably the easy part of this investigation. From here, they've got to go and now try to, you know, to verify, to firm up their cases against the others they believe were involved. And that, from what we understand, that includes people in the Indian Intelligence Service itself, people both that may have been working within Canada and outside in India itself. You know, it's going to be quite difficult. And there's also real barriers to prosecuting when you get to that level. If anybody was involved, say that was here as a diplomat, they would have diplomatic immunity. They could not be arrested. If people were in India that were, you know, with the raw intelligence service that were orchestrating this from within India, it's very hard to imagine that they would face arrest. The most Canada could do would be to ask India to prosecute them within India, but that's not, you know, very likely to happen. So I think the investigation will now go into a much more difficult phase, where, you know, they're going to focus on those connections to the government of India. And, you know, and I also believe try to prevent further killings like this. The issue with this is, as I just said, it's very difficult to bring to justice diplomats or foreign intelligence officers that are pulling the strings and having, you know, local crime groups do their assassinations. If that's the case and there's no consequences for what they do, why would they stop? You know, they're not suffering at all from this, as far as we know. Trudeau, the prime minister, raised this issue last September and quite directly pointed the finger at India, but doesn't appear to have, you know, the Indian government does not appear to have suffered at all.
No.
So, you know, I think that's probably a big part of this as well, is ensuring that this does not become a pattern in Canada, where, you know, not just India, but foreign states feel that they can, with impunity, reach into Canada and assassinate people that they don't like.
No, no doubt. I mean, the whole thing is, even with today's development, is still a real, I mean, not a head scratcher, but it boggles the mind to some extent. I understand from the press conference today, because the RCMP was asked about cooperation with Indian authorities, and they sort of, I mean, in police ease, they said that it's been difficult, and that says a lot.
It's been difficult for a long time. And if, let's think back to why India would have targeted Mr. Najjar. For 10 years or so, they have been accusing him of being a leader of a terrorist faction called the Khalistan Tiger Force. And they've been making repeated requests through Interpol and to Canada directly. They've offered rewards for his arrest. They wanted Canada to arrest him and extradite him. The RCMP never saw any convincing evidence that he actually was involved in violence. Some of the things that the Indian police were saying to try and convince Canada to arrest Mr. Najjar were laughable by the standards, the policing standards and legal standards that we have in Canada. They were targeting him for what reason? Perhaps it was his activism that was the they felt that was a danger because he was a very popular and vocal supporter of the Khalistan movement. And it raises the question, why would India cross this threshold? I think for some time, and in intelligence services have been conducting what you would, foreign interference, even transnational repression in Canada, trying to at least undermine the Khalistan movement here. But last year, they seem to have made a leap into targeted killings. And you have to ask, why would they do that? And the answer is not that the threat has changed, because the threat of Khalistan extremism has not really changed in quite some time. It's been quite low. Evolved into a largely a political movement in Canada. But the answer may be that India's sense of itself has changed. And under Modi, he's a Hindu nationalist. He maybe stands to gain by appearing to be a strong man, standing up to threats to Indian security. And at the same time, this is a moment where Western countries are all pivoting away from China and looking for a different ally in Asia, and they're courting India. So maybe India has a new sense of itself, and a sense that it can get away with this kind of thing.
Right, immunity and impunity at the same time to some extent. Stuart, as always, thank you.
Thanks very much.
In the last half hour, we were talking about arrests today made in connection with the murder of a prominent Sikh activist in Surrey outside of Vancouver last June. Three men were arrested today in Edmonton. And it really did bring up the whole issue of foreign interference, because there are alleged links here to the Indian government, who are suspected of having orchestrated this from behind the scenes. Today, at the very same time as these sort of news of these arrests was leaking, the foreign interference report, the report from the Commission into Foreign Interference in the 2019 and 2021 federal elections, was being revealed in Ottawa. And it was heavily anticipated. We talked about it on the show last night. So what did it find? It found that foreign interference did not undermine the rights of Canadian voters, but it did taint the process and erode public trust. That's the conclusion that came up, that Commissioner Marie-Josée Hogue came up with in her interim report released today at that public inquiry, which highlights some troubling events, she said, in the last two votes. Her findings were tabled more than a year after the first call went out to hold an inquiry into foreign interference. She called it again a stain on our electoral process. But after hearing extensive testimony and reviewing secret documents, here is Hogue on her preliminary conclusions.
Acts of foreign interference did occur during the last two federal general elections, but they did not undermine the integrity of our electoral system. Our system remains sound.
So there is that. In detailing the alleged incidents, Hogue claimed that China was the main perpetrator of foreign interference in this country, and said Beijing tries to influence Canadian government officials, political organizations, candidates, and diaspora communities. So a wide range. Conservative Foreign Affairs critic Michael Chong reacted to the report today, saying the preliminary findings show the Prime Minister didn't share the full impact of foreign interference with Canadians. Chong says that contradicts what Justin Trudeau told the public when he said not a single riding result was impacted.
And so this report is a damning set of conclusions and findings in the first phase of this inquiry about what the Trudeau government has indicated over the last 18 months, and contradicts much of what the government has told us over that period of time.
Michael Chong there. As we discussed in the last half hour with Stuart Bell of Global News, the release of the report came on the same day as the announcement of the arrests of three Indian nationals in Edmonton in connection with the murder of a prominent Sikh activist in Surrey last June. Public Safety Minister Dominic LeBlanc is expected to introduce new rules to counter foreign interference on Tuesday, but had this to say today.
Every Canadian has a fundamental right to live safely and free of threats of violence.
Well, there are a few journalists out there who've had as much impact and done as much work on the foreign interference file as Sam Cooper, investigative journalist. You can find his work on a publication called The Bureau at thebureau.news. And Sam joins me now. Thanks for your time tonight.
Great to be here, Ben.
I guess we should really start with these arrests today, because just as I was reading the report about the foreign interference in the 2019 and 2021 elections, out come news of this these arrests in BC. And wow, what a day. I mean, this is a different form of foreign interference, but it really falls into some of the work you've been doing over the years.
Absolutely. I mean, the allegations that Indian students on student visas could have come into Canada and executed a hit, possibly at the direction of Indian intelligence, really gets exactly to, I would say, the problem that Canada doesn't have a foreign agent registry. And this is, you know, at the heart of both election interference and hostile states that, you know, Ben, I've written a lot about how some of these countries, India, China, Russia, will use criminal and gang networks to target diaspora communities. And so the allegations are serious that India could have used these proxy agents. We don't know too much about them besides, my former colleague Stuart Bell has said, you know, three people arrested, came in on student visas likely. And, students are a big part of this story, whether it's in election threats or, targeting other people for diaspora as proxy agents. So that's what that report is pointing towards. And the timing of the arrests on the morning that this report in Ottawa is released is interesting, to be sure.
To say the very least. Interesting. I mean, the way I read it, and I don't want to be too dramatic about all this, but it was as if there was sort of a small band of assassins moving around Western Canada. Now, all the charges obviously have not been proven in court. We don't know this yet. But, you know, these were sort of alleged gangland hits, as well as alleged, attacks on enemies of the Indian state. I mean, it is relatively mind-boggling. And when you think about it, I always wonder how it is that these countries, whether it be China or India, view Canada. Because it seems to me they feel like there's a certain kind of open season here for these sorts of things.
I would not disagree at all with, you know, your assessment of bands of alleged assassins and the foreign states seeing Canada as a playground. Look, we already have the case, you know, involving an alleged Hell's Angel in Vancouver, allegedly working for Iranian intelligence, mm-hmm. right, who was caught by U.S. law enforcement, in this was a big story a few months ago, that the U.S. Officials stopped, you know, an alleged hit on Iranian diaspora citizens that involved BC organized crime. So that points to, again, Iran allegedly using high profile gangsters in Canada to target individuals, and Canada not stopping it, the United States doing so. And here in this Indian case, again, we have a Canadian dead. We should add that, you know, there's a lot of complexity around diaspora politics regarding mm-hmm. Sikh nationalists and Indian officials accusing Canada of not cracking down on potential organized crime and terror networks within the Sikh community, which would be, you know, some people. This is what the RCMP believe. So, yes, I do think that, as I've reported, Ben, many times, there's issues with foreign state activity in Canada that's not, we don't have the laws to tackle it, including a foreign agent registry. And there are similar issues with organized crime. And I think this story about the hit, the alleged hit in Vancouver, really gets into the heart of both of those issues.
Yeah, let's go to Ottawa now, because originally when I called you up and said, hey, you know, this report's coming out today, you know this stuff inside out, let's talk about it. I was talking to Robert Fife of the Globe and Mail last night, and, you know, we weren't really sure what we were going to see in today's report from Justice Ho, the preliminary report from the inquiry into alleged foreign interference in the 2019 and 2021 elections. And the top line, I guess, is that it didn't have an impact overall in the democratic process, or at least it didn't affect the outcomes of the elections. But I know you went beyond the top line, and there's some interesting stuff in there.
There really is. I would say this is kind of a safe Canadian official report that captures what I believe the evidence showed, and that is there was deep interference in both of the past elections. China was by far the biggest perpetrator. It was clandestine, it was covert. And Justice Hoog found, she said, there's no denying this involved disinformation on the one hand, that is attacks on some candidates, and financial support for others. So to me, that's a big finding because, Ben, as you remember, you know, there's a lot of people that were pushing back on some reports saying these things didn't happen. Justice Hoog says they certainly did. And she said we need to dig deeper in the second phase to understand those two tools of election interference. I think it's reasonable to say that, you know, the commission may have downplayed the impact on the past two elections. I don't think anyone will argue that the Conservative Party would have won either of those two elections. But some people that have watched the commission very closely might say that it could be more than a few ridings in each of those elections that could have been swung. And I don't think this report really gets into that. But what it does say, I'm going to read to you a quote because Sure. this is very important. Justice Hoog said, there is a real risk of politicians modifying their positions or Mm-hmm. their messages as a result of foreign interference. And this risk will increase if we do not take sufficient protective measures to guard against it, end quote. So for me, that's a very strong, I would say, acknowledgement of really what's at stake here. And that is, it's a problem in Canada. Politicians know they could get clandestine support if they tone down messages regarding, you know, perhaps China, India. And on the other hand, if they speak up for what they believe is, you know, Canadian values, they could get attacked. You know, when we sift it all out, I do think that's a strong finding. On the other hand, I don't think that Justice Hoog has really held any individual's feet to the fire. And, you know, arguably, there's a lot to do with a few ridings and the Liberals' response in 2019 and 2021 that I think could lead to stronger findings.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that she really did focus on two ridings, which we've talked a lot about, which was Don Valley West, if I remember correctly. That's Sahan Dong's riding, and then Kenny Chu's riding out here in BC, where she found there was sort of, you know, that there was potential there, that things had been unsavory, things were going on behind the scenes in both cases, in different scenarios. But what's interesting here, I thought, was the bar. Because her bar seems to me is it didn't impact the outcome of the election, but. And then when Aaron O'Toole testified, he said, listen, even if a few votes were changed by this sort of disinformation campaign about what the Conservatives were up to on China, and that, you know, may or may not have cost Kenny Chu his seat. But if one vote was changed, we have a problem. And it feels like the bars are different here.
Yeah, I totally agree. You know, there's a lot of ambiguity in between, you know, some of the evidence in the hearings and how, you know, we hear that on the one hand, it's not proven that any of, you know, the candidates got money, you know, in 2019. On the other hand, you know, it's proven that $250,000 was put into a interference network and that the election threat monitors knew of allegations that some candidates could have been supported with that money and did nothing to intervene. So I don't really find that Commissioner Hoog came down strongly on that point. On the other hand, you know, if we look at the Don Valley North riding, that's Han Don.
I should say Don Valley West, my mistake.
It's actually the north side of Don Valley. And yeah. So, yeah, it was confirmed. I believe that Commissioner Hoog has said even classified intelligence that she can't bring out in the report seemed to strongly confirm that there were irregularities involving international students and Chinese officials directing them to support Mr. Don. And Commissioner Hoog all but says she believes that that was a close contest and China could have pushed the needle on that one. She says that, it's significant that the Liberals wouldn't have lost the riding, but a candidate favored by China could have taken the seat in parliament. And so, you know, Ben, I'll tell you one thing that really interests me that I've really followed for the Bureau on that is sensitive, politically explosive intelligence on Don Valley North has been changed no less than three times.
Right.
Prior to the 2019 election, shortly after, and in 2023 when media leaks come out. So I don't think we're at the bottom of that one yet, but that's an extremely interesting riding. And maybe before I end my answer, you know, I mean, for your BC listeners, the Kenny Chu Richmond riding in 2021, again, I think Commissioner Hogue, she says she can't know for sure, but it's quite possible that Kenny Chu lost and his Liberal opponent won based on Chinese interference. And I think there's more to that one on maybe a warning that the Liberal Party got that wasn't passed to the Prime Minister, as far as I'm parsing, you know, what we can see now in the report.
Sam Cooper from the Bureau is with us this half hour talking about the first report, the preliminary report from the inquiry into allegations of foreign interference in the 2019 and 2021 federal elections. Sam, the big story has always been, what did the Prime Minister and those around him know? When did they know it? And what did they do about it? And I guess we got a bit of a glimpse into them not really taking this all that seriously. They didn't follow up on the Handong nomination thing particularly. They seemed happy just to sort of say, well, you know, it's not that big a deal. And that's the impression I got from the Hogue report as well. Not that she came out and named names or held any feet to the fire. But, you know, there is sometimes what isn't written sometimes interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, one of the most interesting parts of Prime Minister Trudeau's testimony I found was that he indicated in his answers that, you know, there was substance to the intelligence on Handong's riding that he got prior to the election day, but he didn't feel it was enough for him to overturn, a Democratic result. And so Commissioner Hogue followed up with him and said, if you're saying, was there any substance? Well, did you look into it any further after the election? And Mr. Trudeau, it's fair to say, I think he hemmed and hawed a bit and indicated the Liberals did look. But in her report, Justice Hogue says, I can't find any indication of any, you know, sort of attention that did follow from Trudeau or his staff. Another interesting thing that I'm really parsing is the senior Prime Minister's office official mm-hmm. that advised Mr. Trudeau not to intervene in the Handong case. His name is Jeremy Broadhurst. Mm-hmm. The Hogue report says he also received a threat brief that came from CSIS on September 12th, 2021. And I'm going to read here. It briefed Liberal representatives about an issue relating to foreign interference. Mr. Broadhurst testified he received the information, no immediate action was needed, and he was unable to share the information with the Prime Minister before Election Day. So when I'm piecing together that Commissioner Hogue seems very concerned with Kenny Chu's riding, she's concerned with disinformation against Mr. Chu specifically, I'm almost certain that the Liberal Party was briefed potentially that China could have attacked Mr. Chu while it could have potentially supported his opponent, who's named right. Parm Bains, right? The report doesn't come out and say that, but I've read every document that's been tabled line for line. There's a lot of redactions, but I think that it's pointing towards more information that will come out in the second phase, but I do think that riding is a big concern for Commissioner Hogue.
So if you take this all together, I mean, you were one of those who reported very early on this. They had a lot of pushback. Clearly, the Liberals didn't want to have a public inquiry. Now we've had one. We have this first document that come out. These people testified under oath. What do you make of it? Was it worth having this inquiry? And are we learning things that will help shine some light on this?
Yeah, I have, you know, two responses to that. First of all, I don't see how we cannot get a good suite of laws coming out of this second phase. That's what I'm reading in Hogue's first report. I'll read another quote. She says, the acts of interference that occurred are a stain on our electoral process. Mm-hmm. Another key quote for the lawyers out there. She says, this interference, although it may not have decided the government, quote, it impacted the rights of Canadian voters to have a free and fair, well, to not be coerced or suffer covert influence. So I do think that we'll see a recommendation for a foreign agent registry. I think we'll see RCMP and CSIS laws perhaps tweaked. And we could see criminal investigations that arise out of foreign actor proxy interference in the future. And those may not have happened if we didn't have this hearing. I guess I'll sum up my answer by saying, look, as we've been talking about, the whole nub of this story is, could a government ignore CSIS warnings about interference because it's benefiting? Or could a government hold their tongue on, you know, criticizing China or maybe instituting laws, you know, to tackle interference if it felt it was going to be attacked? So if we follow that thought further, look, if this commission didn't come out, if this evidence didn't surface in official documents, people might still be sitting on it and we might not have laws because people may want, they may want to have support from those hostile states.
Yeah, self-censorship. Sam, as always, thank you.
Thanks, Ben.
Going into this week, it was hard to imagine that anything could take focus off Donald Trump's ongoing hush money trial in Manhattan. But something did. Those growing student protests right across the U.S. and, of course, here in Canada as well. We've seen them on campuses in this country, prompting comments from President Biden yesterday after a series of confrontations between police and protesters. The most high profile of them, Tuesday night at Columbia University in New York City after protesters occupied a school building.
NYPD officers are making their way. They are clearly clearing these streets. We see students, we see folks that have been out here for the last several hours watching this group disperse and run in the opposite direction. We also see some pro-Palestinian demonstrators running in front of the police here that is currently in riot gear. This is exactly what the New York City mayor was talking about earlier, telling students to leave the campus.
Yeah, that happened Tuesday. Still no comment from President Biden at that point. And then overnight into Thursday, police breached barricades at a pro-Palestinian encampment on the University of California at Los Angeles, or UCLA campus. Police dismantled the camp, arrested protesters, and removed them from the campus itself.
I'm a student here. I'm an English major. Please, don't fail us. Don't
In
fail-
a place like UCLA, where they tell you this is a place to have a free exchange of ideas and to, you know, learn about the world, yet when you stand up for Gaza, this is what happened.
Yeah, and so yesterday the president in fact addressed the protests and the police actions, saying in America they respect and protect the right of people to make their voices heard, as that UCLA student was making clear, but it must be done without violence, destruction, and hate.
We are not an authoritarian nation where we silence people or squash dissent. The American people are heard. In fact, peaceful protest is in the best tradition of how Americans respond to consequential issues. But, neither are we a lawless country. We are a civil society, and order must prevail.
President Biden speaking yesterday. So we begin our weekly look at the state of play in the U.S. presidential election, not in a courtroom, but on college campuses. Joining me now is Larry Jacobs. He's director of the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the Hubert H. Humphrey School at the University of Minnesota. He's author of a book called Democracy Under Fire. Larry, thanks for your time tonight.
Good to be with you.
Well, this is certainly, I mean, I don't think it caught It might have caught people by surprise this week, because when the week began, it was still sort of simmering. And then as the week progressed, the whole issue about the campus protests really felt like, at least from this side of the border, we've had protests here in Canada as well, but it really felt like the lid came off this week in the U.S.
I think it's been building, and the lid came off at Columbia last week. So I think it's been evolving, and you could probably take it back to the really searing hearings a month ago between Republicans and the House of Representatives and three Ivy League presidents, and which really led to a kind of a backlash against what was going on campus. That led to a hearing with the president of Columbia, who made promises to crack down on speech and actions that threaten Jewish students, and I think that's at the framework and the context for what's happened over the last week and a half, which is entirely, in my view, an overreaction to really a small number of students who overstepped the line, and most students simply voicing their concerns about the violence in Gaza and the growing number of casualties and deaths.
Right. It was interesting to hear the president. Well, first of all, he stayed silent most of the week, which I thought was interesting, and only came out on Thursday to address this. What do you think was behind that? I mean, it's a delicate line to walk for him.
It sure is, because President Biden will lose the election in November to Donald Trump if student turnout is low. And right now, lots of indicators showing that student enthusiasm and willingness to vote, let alone vote for Joe Biden, is really sagging. And so Joe Biden didn't want to come out as someone who was, full on challenging and trying to discredit the students, as was the case among many in the university world and in Congress.
When you look at what he said when he finally did come out, and I listened to the whole speech, it was interesting. I mean, there wasn't really much, there were a lot of nice words in it, but there wasn't much of substance in it necessarily. It was sort of, you have the right to protest, but it can't be this. You can do this, but don't do it this way. And I think we've kind of heard that from the get-go, right?
We have, but it had to be said by the president. And I think he was, in some ways, speaking up for the right of the students to give voice to this anger and frustration that the U.S. continues to give full-on support to the Israeli government of Netanyahu, even as the deaths in Gaza increase. I don't think Joe Biden wanted to be kind of leading the pack with criticism of the student. Coming towards the end of the week, speaking into, kind of a slow news weekend, where the Trump trial and the student protests were going to dominate, was probably about what he wanted to do. Put a marker down, but not be kind of leading the charge.
When we look at what kind of, and you just talked about it briefly, when we look at what kind of impact this could have, because clearly this is going to be, there was new polling out this week that I saw that showed former President Trump was ahead in many of the swing states at this point. I mean, this is going to be a very close election. It feels like every single topic that comes in and interferes with it, whether it be the Trump trial in Manhattan or the student protests, has every single big issue has some kind of impact. You see it through that prism of November's election. How does this, how do these student protests, what could happen here with the Biden presidency campaign, or at least with his chance of becoming, getting a second term, given what's happened?
Well, first off, the election is 6 months off. So
true enough.
The most likely outcome is that this is not going to have an independent effect. I don't think, what's happening this week is going to flip Republicans from being Biden supporters and the Trump supporters. No, of course not. They're already locked in to Donald Trump, and little is going to deter them, including the incredible trials of the last couple weeks. Will this have an impact on Democrats? No, because they're going to be locked in on their president, Joe Biden. Might it have an impact on independents? I don't know. It's just too far away. The big challenge is that it kind of further dampens the interest, the enthusiasm, and likely support for Joe Biden. That has been an issue for the last 6 months, and I think it's going to be an issue for it's going to continue to be an issue, maybe even a stronger challenge to Joe Biden's campaign over the next 6 months.
When you look at what impact it could have on American policy towards Israel, that's been another interesting one, because he certainly didn't talk about it much this week. But you can feel like there is pressure on him now, and it certainly he seems to have been putting pressure on Benjamin Netanyahu, at least behind the scenes, to try and find some way to curb this, he's upset about the humanitarian situation, clearly. He's upset about this talk of going into Rafah, clearly. But he's been, he's been kind of rebuffed at times by Benjamin Netanyahu. Do these protests push him into a more forceful exchange with Israel at this point?
I don't know about the protests. I think the fact that you've got so many Americans, there's a majority of Americans now who are critical of Netanyahu's policies in Gaza and the horrific casualties in Gaza of many civilians as well. And so I would say it's been more of a drumbeat of pressure on Netanyahu and the government to change course, to strike a ceasefire, and to begin to provide significant humanitarian aid in Gaza. That is, you know, that is underway, and it's quite possible we're going to see a ceasefire for perhaps 6 weeks in the next couple of days. And I think that reflects the real challenge that Joe Biden is facing. It's from the students, but also he's quite aware of the critical support he needs from Arab American voters, from Muslim voters in swing states where literally 10,000 or so votes will make the difference.
I think so far this has probably been really the most dynamic and frankly revealing testimony, in the sense that Hope Hicks has never spoken, but in some ways I think Hope Hicks was bracing herself, because you have to remember one thing about every person that has left Donald Trump's orbit: they have received the counterpunch from Donald Trump. Hope Hicks knows that. She orchestrated that for many years.
Yeah, the trial, the ongoing trial in Manhattan, Donald Trump's hush money trial today, there's been some really interesting witnesses on the stand this week. And today it was Hope Hicks. Of course, she was the former communications advisor during Trump's presidency. She talked about her relationship with her former boss and about a conversation she had with Trump in 2018 about the $130,000 payment to porn star Stormy Daniels. And it was a really emotional day for her. I mean, there is no cameras or audio in the trial, so we're relying on reporting here. Larry Jacobs is director of the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the Hubert H. Humphrey School at the University of Minnesota. His book is called Democracy Under Fire. Larry, I don't know how much attention you're paying to this trial, but I mean, I try to watch, you know, U.S. news most days for at least a few minutes. It's kind of hard to avoid, isn't it?
It sure is. No, I've been following it probably too closely. You know, it's just remarkable in a lot of ways. I mean, obviously, you've got the first president of the United States indicted, and he is sitting there in the courtroom. He has to be there. And maybe for the first time, at least in his adult life, he's sitting face to face with people who are saying, you know, very harsh, embarrassing things about him, and reporting on his, you know, seemingly outrageous, immoral behavior. It's just an extraordinary scene. And there were people so far who, you know, he's worked with closely. He would consider some of them to be, people he has strong, warm feelings towards, including Hope Hicks, who he had, you know, a very strong personal relationship with.
What have you made then of this week? Because I know Michael Cohen was up. That was a big one. Hope Hicks today. I mean, clearly the prosecution is trying to build this case that Donald Trump was fully aware about what this money was for, who it was going to, and why.
So the key thing in this trial is that Donald Trump falsified entries into their corporate accounts. And in doing so, that is, you know, a small crime. For this to become a larger crime, they need to link those falsified entries with efforts to subvert the election. A lot of the attention is to show that Donald Trump was very much engaged in a conspiracy to prevent Americans from knowing about these affairs he was having, the sex he was having with a Playboy bunny and with a porn star. And Hope Hicks is another character who's come forward and said, yes, he was in the room with Donald Trump. They were talking about payments for the Playboy bunny. And that's just, you know, it's being used by the prosecution to build their case. We've heard from National Enquirer publisher who reported on the kind of shenanigans that he engaged in to try to kill stories. All that is to build a credible case that these payments were geared towards undermining the 2016 U.S. election.
So if we add it all up, you know, the campus protests, Biden coming out yesterday, the Trump trial, all of it this week, Where do we stand today? It feels like we're kind of still, I mean, you mentioned earlier, obviously, we're still 6 months away, actually 6 months and 2 days to be exact. But I mean, not much changed this week, but it really feels like, I mean, there's so many subplots going on in this presidential election already. I mean, you couldn't have written it basically 15 years ago.
No, this is an extraordinary election. And what I would say is, you know, you can look at this election in several ways and come away without really an answer. On the one hand, Joe Biden is facing a very difficult campaign, and perhaps no president since Jimmy Carter has had, you know, the calamity that has broken out around him. Not only is he extraordinarily unpopular, but we've now seen the economy turning in a, you know, potentially quite negative direction. Inflation is weighing down on Americans and very much hurting his approval ratings. You've got the immigration going on the southern border, but that's down substantially over the last month or so. Then you bring in these important groups of voters who are so far deserting, including, as we've been talking about, younger voters. But you could add into that voters of color. You know, it just doesn't look good for him. And as you mentioned, the polls show him behind, you know, not by a lot, a little bit. On the other hand, you've got Donald Trump, who could very well be convicted. And we know from some of the polling that if he is convicted, that could have a real impact on the election. Not a huge impact because the Republicans are unified behind him. But enough that would set him back in some of these very close so-called battleground states.
Right. The margins are so thin. Larry, thank you so much. Have a great weekend.
You too. Thanks for having me.
There was a bit of a situation in the primary bedroom. Originally, I wanted to do something really interesting with some rope detailing in the ceiling.
We are going to hang this from the ceiling in Sue's room.
And then we wanted a ceiling fan. Ropes and a fan, Deborah? You can't have a ceiling fan with a bunch of ropes hanging around it.
Sometimes your designer brain gets so excited about something.
Yes.
It's not fully thought out.
A small sample of season 5 of Scott's Vacation House Rules, which is underway now. It's back on HGTV, airing Monday nights. You can also find it on Stack TV, of course. If you haven't seen the show, and you should because it is really entertaining, Scott McGillivray and designer Deborah Salmoni, who you heard there, joined forces to help owners transform their properties into great vacation rentals. And when you reach a season 5, that means finding new and different projects, novel projects to tackle. So this year, they take on a bison farm, convert a dingy garage into a colorful cabin retreat, make over a century-old farmhouse into a wedding venue, and for the first time ever, they tackle a brand new build. Listen, it's a fun show. Deborah Salmoni is with me now to talk about season 5. Deborah, welcome back. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. Thank you so much. It's really,
you know,
lovely.
I watch a lot of these shows just because, you know, we all do. And, you know, I worked in TV for a long time. You know what I love about your show is your chemistry, because you just can't invent that. And it looks like you're actually having fun, like having a lot of fun.
We are. We're having a blast. We really, really are. But I mean, I think that both of us in our everyday lives as well. I mean, you know, you got to enjoy yourself. You can't take it too seriously. We're renovating houses, we're designing homes. It's high pressure, right? These are huge investments, and you're dealing with a lot of money. So we definitely don't take that lightly. However, the whole process, you have to enjoy it. Like, you really do. You got to just enjoy it, and you have to poke fun at each other. You have to laugh about things, because what we see in some of these cottages is just unbelievable.
Yeah, no kidding.
It really is.
And the trust factor comes out a lot too. I mean, obviously you trust each other's judgment, yeah, and the people you work for trust you. And I always found one of the big barriers when it comes to big renovation projects is trust.
Oh yeah, my gosh. I mean, first of all, it starts with the homeowners trusting us. Like, that is a huge consideration. You know, they're like, okay, we're, and not only are they just trusting us, like with my own business, my own personal design studio that I run, my clients are very involved. Right. So they are very involved. They're as involved as they want to be. I'm very collaborative with them. I include them in a lot of the decisions. I want them to be a part of it. With the show, they, like, I meet with them We talk about design, you know, what they like, what they don't like, and then they're gone. They don't get to see anything. They don't get to pick anything. They don't get to approve anything. And then they come back on reveal day. So trust, trust us with everything, which is really, really fantastic. And again, something that we definitely don't take lightly, because obviously the goal here is to create a fabulous property that is amazing for short-term rental, but these like that the homeowners feel like it's their cottage.
Yeah.
Right? Like they have that emotional attachment to it still.
Indeed. And one of the things I found really interesting reading just about the launch of season 5, because I wonder sometimes as a viewer, I forget this sometimes. There are the two of you who are central to all of this. There's clearly the homeowner, but a big character in your show is the property itself. And it was, I was interested in how you essentially audition the properties.
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, we have people apply. And we have people apply from all over.
You must get a lot of applications.
We do. We get a lot of applications. So there's a couple factors that go into it. Obviously, the scope of the job. You know, this isn't a never-ending process. We have to be done between 4 to 6 months. So the scope of the work has to be manageable within that time frame. Number one. Two, location. You know, so we have to make sure, because a lot of the times crew, myself, Scott included, we have to spend time there. We have to sleep there. So like, where are the closest hotels? Where are the closest hospitals? Like all of those things come into consideration, right? So often it could be an hour away from where the property is, because they're very remote areas. And then we like to try to group a few in the same area. So if you're staying up there, let's say for 4 days or for 3 days, you can hit up a couple properties. You have connections with contractors, right? So like all of these things come into play, and just diversity. You're making sure that these properties are a little bit different. Some of the properties are just deep in the woods. Some of the properties are on the water. Some of them are on a winery. Some of them are, you know, on a farm. So you want to make sure that there's a bison variety.
My jaw dropped when I saw that, a bison farm. Did you pick that? But then obviously I've been watching it, it really is a compelling place to watch be transformed.
So cool. And I mean, I feel like for me, you know, there's different types of vacations that you want to take, right? So sometimes there's just like, I just want a beach. I don't really want to think about much. I want that all-inclusive mentality of just being on a beach and relaxing. And then other times you want an experience. You're like, I want to do something different. And I feel like that's what the bison farm is all about. You're like, okay, so I'm going to get up in the morning and I'm going to feed these bison and I'm going to watch all of that go. And I'm going to walk the property. I'm going to walk the farm. I'm going to do a little bit of lassoing. And it's really fun. It's a fun, fun property.
Indeed. Are either of you sort of have any farm experience? Because I grew up like urban jungle, right? And I've spent a little bit of time on farms, but I always feel a little bit like a fish out of water.
No. My gosh. Me on a farm? No, I grew up in Brampton.
There you go. Yes, I've been to Brampton. It used to be farmland.
Yeah, exactly. I feel like my parents, I was born in Toronto. My parents were like, we're going to take you to the farmland and you're going to grow up with fresh air. And then the Brampton became Brampton and now I'm back in Toronto. So indeed, it's really full circle.
You did some new stuff in this series though, right? I mean, you had some different challenges that we hadn't seen before. Just the venue itself, but there was a new build involved. I mean, I don't want to give away, the show is in progress, so I don't want to give too much away. Turn it on and watch. Yeah. But there was a lot of challenges coming up in this one.
Yeah, every Monday night you can watch a new episode, that's for sure. But yes, we did a new build, which we've never done before in the show. So that was a huge, huge, massive undertaking and a very emotional storyline. I would be surprised if you did not cry when you watch that episode. It's quite emotional. We did a pink cottage, which is pretty amazing, with a beautiful influencer who's awesome. So the Birds Papaya, her name is Nicole. She's wonderful. She was fantastic. Her property's fantastic. I mean, when you get the opportunity to paint a cottage pink, you're like, I'll do that. I'm just not sure.
I think I saw that in a movie recently. Yeah.
Right? Like, that's just not going to come across my desk. Again, so I jumped on that one. We did the bison farm. We did a beautiful Victorian venue, which is like, you know, people are so into micro weddings now.
Yep.
So we transformed this gorgeous Victorian into a venue. We transformed just a raggedy old garage into a two-bedroom, mid-century modern, outstanding property. Like, fabulous, fabulous. I got to have my kids on the show, which was really exciting. Yeah, so they came on an excursion with me. You know, we always try to do these, like, a little bit of research, right? It's always like, okay, let's do something different. You're always trying to think outside the box. Let's do something different for the show. And so I was able to have Tom and Lizzie come with me and do this awesome excursion, which was really, really fun.
Wow. Yeah. My mom was on TV when I was a kid. It's a weird thing because you try to act all nonchalant about it, but you're not. I guarantee your kids aren't. Yeah.
I know. The kids were wild. Something that, no, they were so good. They really were amazing. And again, our crew is so fabulous. You know, like my director, he's just wonderful with kids. We have to deal with kids all the time, right? So he has a way with them. And so that was great and different. I've never had my kids on TV. But we've done some really big properties for season 5, which was fun, but absolutely pushed the envelope with them.
I guess that therein lies the challenge, right? Each year you're challenging yourself. You know that viewers might want to see something a little bit different, although they might just watch the same thing again and again. But just for you, you want it to grow at the same time.
Of course, absolutely. I mean, we're on season 5, right?
Wow.
So you try to bring like 72 episodes, I think Scott was saying. And so you try to bring fresh ideas. You try to be even more creative. You learn a lot during the process itself. And it's also, to your point, earlier, you were saying like the shows are a big part of, I mean, the properties are a big part of the show.
Yep.
Right. And so you're like, okay, this one's different. This one is different. We have to do it.
Deborah, congratulations on season 5. Man, it's gone by fast. And thanks so much for your time tonight. I appreciate it.
Thank you. It's been wonderful. And we'll chat soon, I'm sure.
My grandmother O'Hara really did like music. She used to tell me these incredible stories after she was widowed about dancing with my grandfather when they were younger in places like Grand Bend on Lake Huron and so on. And Perry Como was one of her favorites. That was her jam, so to speak. But when we used to have birthday parties for her, she got older, like 75 and so on, she always seemed to enjoy the music no matter what was being played, whether it was modern or whether it was the kind of stuff that brought back those kinds of memories for her. And that kind of surprised me because at the time, of course, I was still a teenager. And when you're young, you kind of like what you like and the other stuff you don't like. So if Perry Como came on when I was 15, I'd be like, I don't want to listen to that, right? But it turns out that science may have a bit of an explanation for what I was witnessing. The brains of older adults feel a sense of reward, it turns out, when listening to music, even if it's a song they don't particularly like. Get that? The brains of older adults feel a sense of reward when listening to music, even if it's a song they don't really like. While younger adults only get the same satisfaction out of music they do actually enjoy. Sarah Faber is a postdoctoral fellow at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver. She carried out the research and she joins me now. Sarah, thank you.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
I always find anything to do with how the brain reacts to music absolutely fascinating because I'm a big music fan and I used to spend quite a bit of time at my grandmother's house when I was young and she obviously was like a big Perry Como fan. And I'd come over with these sort of hits and I'd put them on and she actually didn't mind them. And I always wondered, how could that be? Because I think she would really dislike them, but there might have been an answer in your research here to why my sort of senior citizen grandmother would groove to just about anything back in the day.
Oh yeah, it sounds like your grandmother and my grandmother were very, very similar people. Like mine had a lot of the Beatles and like Jerry and the Pacemakers, but she would happily listen to whatever I was into at the time. And she's like, oh, well, this is interesting, you know?
They just said the brain, you found out. I mean, I'll let you get into the details, but when we're younger, music is a reward that is somewhat selective. And when we're older, music is a reward in of itself.
Absolutely. So this was work that I did during my PhD with collaborators down at Northeastern University in Boston. And what we were interested in was looking at differences in music listening between younger and older adults. So folks came into the lab, recorded fMRI, so that big metallic donut, and had them listening to selections of music, both familiar, well-liked music that they brought with them, and then music that was a researcher selected. So this was a combination of music that would have been popular when they were in high school, university age, or music that was brand new, that was designed to be a little bit weird, a little funky.
A little bit
and
grating.
After every single, go ahead.
Yeah. No, go ahead. So after every single one?
Yeah, so after every single excerpt that we played in the scanner, participants answered questions on how much they liked the piece of music. So between 1 and 4, did you hate the music or did you really love it? And then how familiar were you with the piece of music? Again, from 1 to 4, have you never heard it before or are you really familiar with it? And then with all of that data, we started looking at, okay, what are the differences between liked music and disliked music, or liked music and not as well loved music? And then what were the differences between the age groups? And, you know, about 600 different ways to split up this data set. It was really exciting.
Right. And you found some interesting stuff, because I would have thought as you get older, because a lot of people, you know, you hear older folks, and I'm one of them now, sort of say, well, you know, there's no good new music these days. There's no good
music. What are the kids these days listening to?
What are they listening to? You know, back in my day, you know, Lionel Richie. I mean, you know, it's odd. But you found that, in fact, that is true, that in fact, it's the opposite, that the older folks tend to like music, period, or at least their brains like react well to it.
Yeah, and that was something that was a bit of an incidental finding. So I was looking at differences between younger and older adults, and we're like, all right, or I initially started looking at differences between well-liked and less well-liked music, and music that was familiar versus music that wasn't as familiar.
Right.
And we're like, okay, well, we have really good results. Like, I look at brain networks. So the first network I was looking at was the auditory network. People are using their ears and the parts of the brain that are behind the ears that, you know, take in all of this delicious auditory stimuli we're taking in all the time, you know, listening to the radio, just ambient noise. Unfortunately, the Nobel Prize Committee hasn't gotten in touch with my amazing finding.
Not yet.
Their ears. Not yet.
It's early.
Yeah, I'm still waiting for that call for next year. So the auditory network, which is the ears and everything that is connected to the ears, was really important for us. But then there was another network, an auditory reward network. And so this pulls in regions from the front and the middle of the brain that you see when people are doing something rewarding. So for people listening to music that they liked, we saw this auditory reward network, and we're like, great, that makes sense. Does not always happen, especially in brain research, but this is great news. But then when I was digging around a little bit more, I was like, well, people might have really liked music that they weren't super familiar with. So let's take a look at those liking and familiarity ratings and see what we can see. And with younger adults, there was a very clear relationship between music they liked, music they knew, and this auditory reward network. Whereas for older adults, they still had a wealth of difference between the music that they liked and the music they didn't like. It wasn't just that they liked everything, but the brain activity told us something different. They were getting this auditory reward network activity, even from music that they rated as not as special or stunning as the stuff that they brought in with them.
Interesting. Why do you think that? I mean, I know it's hard to hypothesize and why that might be, but to lead into the broader research here, because this isn't just about figuring out whether young people like familiar music more than older people, or older people like more music than younger people do. But what do you think that may be? And how does it play into the greater studies that you're doing, which is really about trying to figure out how we listen to music as we get older, as it relates to sort of dementia, Alzheimer's, and so on, because music can be incredible therapy, right? For people suffering from those sorts of illnesses at the time.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. So before I was in the science gig, I worked as a music therapist and primarily long-term care and adult mental health. So this is really, I got to see, you know, if you've been on the internet at all in recent years, chances are you've seen one of these videos of somebody, you know, with dementia or with Alzheimer's being played music, and they did kind of come back into themselves a bit. And this I got to see live several times, and it was incredible. But I really wanted to understand what was kind of getting at that. So we think about brain development often as something that, you know, we got babies, we got kids, we got teens, we got adults, and then your brain is developed. But the brain never really stops optimizing, for lack of a better word. The brain is constantly developing and changing in response to what we're doing and different things that we get up to, both at work and in our downtime. And so there's a lot of variability naturally across healthy human adulthood. And what we really need to do as researchers is start looking at what this variability can tell us, both about, you know, how humans age healthily, and then also see if there's anything in there that can tell us who is likely to develop dementia, who is likely to respond really well to treatment, what kind of treatment, who is more at risk or not. And music is a really good way of doing this, because it is accessible to people, you know, healthy adults and people with Alzheimer's disease. Both groups can listen to music and have a fantastic time. Whereas this isn't the case for doing something like a sit-down conversation, an interview, right, especially if someone has neurodegeneration that's affected their ability to speak and to understand language. So for me, this is evidence of the brain's, you know, of the brain's shiftiness, maybe right, not shiftiness, but evidence that the brain does continue to develop and change with healthy, normal aging. And so we think, we can also tend to think about aging as something that's negative. You know, we get older, I've got, you know, back pain from sleeping. You know, I'm not even doing anything fun. I get up and my neck is completely out of joint. But with the brain, this could be the brain kind of pushing us into something enjoyable. It's like, okay, we don't have this extremely specific response to music that we like and music that we're familiar with anymore, but we still get to enjoy it. That's potentially an adaptation, which I think is kind of cool.
That is. Where do you go from? I mean, that is very cool, because you think of, I've seen those videos, right? They're remarkable.
Yeah, absolutely.
They are, because you can see, it's almost like music rolls back the years, and that might be a negative way of putting it, but it feels like it's that, right? It reaches a place that sometimes feels like it might be unreachable at this point in time.
Oh, for sure. And this can go like really well, and it can go really poorly, because there's a lot of junk music that I really disliked when I was in high school that I remember every single word of.
Well, of course. Speaking of the brain, if you know how to purge a mind full of bad lyrics from 80s songs, you let me know, because I know this is a terrible analogy, but I could use some space. Where do you go from here? I mean, this is really interesting findings about how the brain reacts to music, how it differs as you age. Where do you go next?
Well, where we go next is starting to work with people with dementia. So we have some really great contacts with Michael Smith Health Research BC and the BC Alzheimer's Society. And we're working with them to recruit people that have dementia and that have a diagnosis of mild to moderate Alzheimer's disease. So we're going to do similar types of things, have them come into the lab, listen to a selection of music that they're familiar with, that they really like, pick some music that they're maybe not expecting. And then just look at the brain, at what the brain is doing, and lining it up with healthy, we call it healthy control. So people who are the same age that do not have a diagnosis, start looking at people in younger and middle adulthood. Because again, we often see younger versus older adults. But if you think about who you were as a 20-year-old versus who you are as a 30-year-old, there's a lot of development that happens in between those two things. And then, you know, the difference between 30 and 40, 40 and 50, all the way up. There's a lot of missing information in there, but a lot of really exciting stuff that we can go and find now.
Well, Sarah, thank you so much. I appreciate it. Have a nice weekend.
Thank you so much. You as well. Take care.
Canada may be known for its landscapes and friendly people, but beneath the surface lies a darker side of crime, history, and the paranormal. Since 2017, the award-winning Dark Poutine podcast has explored the shadowy corners of the Great White North and beyond, delivering chilling tales from a uniquely Canadian perspective. Hosted by Mike Brown and Matthew Stockton, with over 300 episodes and fresh releases every Monday, Dark Poutine is your weekly ticket to the creepier side of Canada. Listen to Dark Poutine on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.